now going to ask, I don't know which sequence they prefer, Mike first, to some comments, then David, then a discussion.
Okay, thank you. So for those who weren't yesterday, I'm Mike Hume from the School of Environmental Sciences at the University of Estonia. I hope this reflection fits broadly in this morning session, but what I thought I wanted to do is to pick up on something that just struck me yesterday, listening to some of the contributions. And in particular, I think it may have been Emmeline's talk after lunch, putting the past, present, and future time dimensions together. And so that was a concatenation of time, which museums perhaps have found difficult to do in the past. I don't find intuitively that those three dimensions of past, present, and future fit together. Whereas, of course, with climate change, one has to think about those three different time dimensions. And that got me thinking about the nature of science, and again, because the focus of this, it seems to me, is about science centres or science museums in the context of climate change. And of course, how science itself, as a human institution, changes over time, past, present, and future. And as a way in, it strikes me, to helping visitors and public understand the contribution that scientific knowledge can make to our thinking about future challenges like climate change, would be to focus or to give examples of how scientific practices have changed over time, particularly in relation to climate. And this would seem to be one way of connecting these three different time dimensions, past, present, and future. And so, for example, if one thinks about a number of ways this could manifest itself, so you could think about different ways in which climate, the idea of climate, has been understood and represented in different societies and different cultures over time. Aboriginal cultures, pre-Western cultures, post-Western cultures. And this also then begins to touch on another dimension, I guess, of this conversation, which Elaine particularly focused on, about the representation of different worldviews in museum exhibitions. And of course, these different ways of thinking about climate over time do emerge from very different worldviews. So the ways Aboriginal cultures think about climate, or indeed the way in early modern European societies thought about climate, very different from the way in which contemporary scientific practices would think about climate. Or indeed, ideas that, for example, Jim Lovelock has introduced into thinking about Earth system science, and the metaphor of Gaia as a conceptual device for thinking about interconnectedness on the planet. Is Gaian thinking consistent with a scientific worldview? Would one actually want to introduce a Gaian conceptual framework into a science museum? Or would that be going beyond the cultural worldview that a science centre would be deemed legitimate? It seems to me that in some of the discussion yesterday, trying to draw fixed boundaries between what is legitimate to represent in science museums around climate and what is not legitimate is a very difficult line to draw. And the idea of Gaia, I think, captures that. And then the other thing I just to say about this idea of how science changes over time in relation to climate and climate change. One can think about taking a particular item, and the one that comes to mind is the item of sea level rise, which I mentioned a few times yesterday. In fact, in my talk I mentioned about how the IPCC reports of over four generations now have come up with rather different projections of what the projection range is for sea level rise over the next 100 years. We actually had someone intervening yesterday with an email from the Arctic Monitoring Assessment saying, oh well, the latest estimate is now saying that sea level rise is going to be between 0.9 and 1.6 metres. So real time modification of numbers. But what I'm thinking here is to help visitors and citizens understand how scientists, in this case dealing with sea lorelei, how do scientists actually deliberate and weigh different pieces of evidence about sea lorelei? And whether actually those processes of scientific deliberation, I mean, classically this is how the IPCC works. The IPCC comes up with numbers through expert deliberation, sitting around tables and looking at evidence, arguing about evidence, agreeing or disagreeing with each other, and in the end, reaching some sort of deliberative consensus about what an appropriate number range is. And actually exploring that very process of how scientists do deliberation, I think would be very educational and opening up for citizens to understand. And is that process of deliberation that scientists do any different from the sort of deliberation that you and I, as ordinary citizens, might do in other contexts of life? So we could even enact a deliberative process that demonstrates how scientists do deliberation, or even get people to do role plays in some interactive way to see how difficult it is for scientists to deal with deep uncertainties and how those processes of deliberation don't lead to truth. They lead to what I call yesterday partial and provisional knowledge. And those numbers will change, as indeed they changed yesterday. It's now 0.9 to 1.6 metres, I believe. And by next week it will be something different again. So those are my reflections on past, present and future, the changing ways in which science or scientific concepts or cultural worldviews influence the way in which we have knowledge about climate and climate change.
And my name's David Caroli. I'm a nerd. I'm a climate scientist. I have thick glasses and a range of other attributes. I was going to reflect on these perspectives and the language that we use in terms of engagement. The context here is engagement and risk and uncertainty. And there are two quite different ways that, even as scientists, we talk about risk and uncertainty. And we talked yesterday in the discussion quite a lot about uncertainty in terms of whether people receiving messages prefer definite, certain information or prefer to receive reliable information about the range of uncertainties and whether that can lead to better engagement or worse engagement. And that often depends on the audiences and their expectations. And as Mike has just described, better representing how scientists deliberate about uncertainty and risk is one way that may allow audiences to engage with or understand a broad range of uncertainty. Of course, there are other perceptions, and that is, if myself as a scientist provides uncertain information, some groups might focus on the least impactful range in that uncertainty, whereas other groups, because of their framing, will focus on the highest impact range on that uncertainty. And so there's been a tendency in some organisations to focus on one aspect of an uncertain range. And in the sea level rise discussions, some groups will focus on it's only going to be 20 centimetres in 2100, because that's the lower bound of the IPCC, and that's smaller than the day-to-day tidal range. We don't have to worry about it. Other groups will talk about 1 metre of sea level rise in 2100, and that will dislocate more than 100 million people every year. So which one of those depends upon the audience? I actually want to talk about a different aspect of risk and uncertainty. And that's the risk that an organisation like a museum, or the risk that a scientist like myself gets exposed to when we engage audiences who have very different frames or worldviews about climate change. And the examples that I'm going to talk about are two specific examples, one involving me, one involving the Australian Museum. I'm a climate scientist. I guess, naively, I thought that providing information and seeking to engage with community was something that was without risk. However, the evidence that I've gained over the last 10 years or more is that as a scientist, if you want to engage with communities and a range of audiences, that some of them are likely to come at you not just with other information, but with knives and other weapons, because they believe that destroying the messenger will destroy the message. And there are real organizations that seek to destroy the messenger. And an example was the ClimateGate attacks on the University of East Anglia, but it has affected me. There is a serial complainer who every 6 months writes a 10 to 50 page official complaint to my university's Chancellor and Vice-Chancellor saying that I am involved in academic misconduct. He knows the process, he knows how to make these complaints, and he does it, and he documents it. One of the complaints is, I received an email as part of ClimateGate, so that demonstrated misconduct by me. And yes, if you search through the archives, David Caroli did receive and send emails to the University of East Anglia. And his view is that demonstrates misconduct. Now, that's very strange. Completely different perspective. The Australian Museum engaged in what they thought was a very scientifically robust and reliable exhibition on climate change science and approaches that would engage with the community, and was somewhat taken aback when a relatively well-known journalist posted on the website prior even to the official opening of the museum, without even coming to the exhibition, a number of extremely critical comments about the Australian Museum exhibition on climate change. And then the website of the Australian Museum and the exhibition got a number of hits, and again, somewhat organized responses that pointed out the lack of value and produced a biased response. There is a paper on this that is published in the Museum and Society online sort of series of publications. If you're interested, Linda or Frank can tell you more about this, but there is a risk in engaging in climate change science and exhibitions, even if you think that you're doing the most reliable and scientifically correct information. And that risk is putting your head above the parapet is likely to lead to either real or potential attack.
We have three very interesting perspectives around that question of risk. Saffron saying, I think I agree, absolutely don't use, overuse fear or alarm, so don't use that as your main plank for engaging people with climate change. Mike talking about better representation about how we think about uncertainty and risk, and David's very clear and forceful points about the sort of reputational risk and risk of attack that we suffer, any of us engaged in the debate. So.